Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, America welcomed Hillary Clinton into the 2016 presidential race. Did you hear about this? If you haven't heard about this, please let us know the location of your fortress of solitude and how much it would cost to rent a room there for the next, let's say, 570 days. We are totally happy to wash dishes and mow lawns, so let's negotiate. Meanwhile, who says the House of Representatives aren't generous people? Why, just this week, the House voted to offer upwards of $250 billion in handouts to needy Americans. And by needy Americans, we mean the decadent layabout heirs of our nation's top plutocrats. So really, we mean useless Americans. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Amanda Turkle. Some guy landed a gyrocopter on Congress's lawn this week, giving hope to everyone who'd like to see Capitol Hill skies choked with homemade flying contraptions. But here's what happened first. Okay, it's once again time for So That Happened, the podcast of events that have previously occurred in space and time. My name is Jason Linkins. Today I'm joined in the HuffPost Washington, D.C. podcast redoubt by two of my colleagues, beginning with
Amanda Turkle.
And what are you, Amanda? Tell the people what you are.
I am a politics reporter here at HuffPost.
Right. And of course, we can't do anything without our good friend
Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter
right.
for the Huffington Post.
There you go. I'm Jason Linkins, editor of Eat the Press. With so much to talk about today and so little time to talk about it, but I first want to talk about how about that dude yesterday in the auto gyro, gyrocopter? Did you guys see that? Am I the only one in this office who's paying attention to that story?
So it's both minimally? Sort of a neat story. It's like he's a postal worker, just a guy who wants to get the word out on campaign finance reform, and he even painted the postal logo on his gyrocopter. But it's also actually a really sad story.
To reassure people.
Because he was inspired to do this by his son's horrifically brutal suicide. So that was sort of a sad part people aren't remembering.
I thought he was inspired to do this about campaign finance reform.
There's that, but he also did it in part because his son drove into traffic and committed suicide, and that sort of made him think about all this. So there's a very sad underlining.
Mm. Oh, well, way to take the joy out of this weird story, Amanda. I mean, that is sad.
It's more fun if a toy helicopter crashed into
right.
into the White House
yeah,
lawn
so
for no
guy,
reason.
This guy flew his gyrocopter down onto the Capitol lawn.
And it's like a remote control helicopter.
He was riding it.
He was in it.
Yeah, it's like a bicycle. If it was a remote control helicopter.
Well, that's a lot cooler.
Then only like 50 reporters would have covered it.
Right.
As opposed to everyone who felt obligated to cover it because it was happening in Washington, D.C. And he was arrested. And my kind of thing is that I'm surprised by so many people who just suggested, oh, well, he should have been shot down.
Yeah, that's bad.
Like Joe Scarborough today was just like, they should have shot him down. I was like, what?
I mean, he also was very public that he was going to do this.
He
gave interviews
everybody.
In the local press. He told everyone. People apparently also called authorities and said, this guy's going to do this because they were concerned that he would be shot down. And he wasn't a threat to anyone. It is weird that NORAD did not detect him. And I think that is their problem, not his. But, you know, I thought it was neat.
He didn't hurt anybody.
Right.
Don't
right.
kill people who don't hurt anybody.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. I'm just like, what will satisfy your thirst for blood, Joe Scarborough? You know, shoot an old man down out of the sky in his little bicycle-powered
That's
helicopter.
Interesting because Joe Scarborough has been in the past critical of Obama's excessive use of force, what Joe Scarborough called excessive use of force with the drone program and with the wars in Afghanistan.
Well, I mean,
in the past, that was years ago. I don't know what he thinks about that stuff now.
That's the kind of position you take when you can feel high and mighty about yourself. as opposed to just shooting an old man down out of the sky. I should point out that I just read on Twitter that Joe Scarborough said this, so maybe I'm completely wrong. We'll have an editor or a producer fact check it. I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking starting this conversation about gyrocopters. I sort of think that maybe the lesson learned here is that, like, the people need to pool their resources, build gyrocopters, and fly them all here at once. Safety in numbers, after all.
And that would be hard to stop.
And then we will get campaign finance reform.
And then we'll get campaign finance reform. I mean, how else are we going to get campaign finance reform?
Well, I heard we were going to pass a constitutional amendment, and that was going to fix
you
everything.
You did hear that. Yeah.
We are talking about campaign finance reform today a lot more than it's been talked about in recent weeks or months or years.
Look, I'm not trying to say I am actually pro fly your campaign finance reform gyrocopter to Washington. Like, ride your campaign finance reform tractor into a reflecting pool and stay there.
How high can you go in these things? Like, could we put a gyrocopter landing pad on top of our office to, like, bring people here? Because we're pretty close to the White House.
I think we have enough room to park, I think, 4 or 5 gyrocopters safely. After that,
only hang gliders.
I mean, because we have very limited expertise in aerospace Mm-hmm. Whatever you need to, the training.
Exactly, demonstrating our lack of expertise.
Like, yeah, exactly. So I don't even know the word for it. But, like, I can tell you that you can really only count on me to like, guide a few planes in for a landing. I'm no, you know, dude on the deck of an aircraft carrier. I think that collectively we might be able to handle, you know, 5 or 6.
Yeah.
But there's plenty of space to land things in every time. There's all these triangular parks all over D.C., there's the mall. You can land.
Barrett Square.
You know, land before the kickball players start.
Land before time.
They will kick your ass.
Land before time.
They are drunk and dumb. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I think people need to just fly their weird contraptions to Washington. That's what I want more people flying more weird contraptions to Washington. I want this to look like the Red Bull Flugtag around here.
I don't know what that is, but it sounds cool.
But for campaign finance reform, look it up on YouTube, the
Twitters.
Red Bull Flugtag. It's just like it's a contest of bad aerospace technology falling into the water.
Is Elon Musk involved?
Elon Musk, well, probably. Who knows? But okay, so you mentioned that we're going to get a campaign constitutional amendment, Amanda. Who's going to do that for us?
I don't. Actually, that was Zach who mentioned that, but I don't know if we're going to get it. I think people want to get it, including Hillary Clinton.
Oh, right,
has
right,
talked
right.
about it.
Hillary Clinton, she did something this week, right?
She mentioned that she would like to, you know, get more money out of politics and that a constitutional amendment might be the way to do it. So, you know, that was Hillary little by little is talking about her policy positions. And so this was one that got people's attention.
Right. Perhaps we should just back up and just like let the readers know, listeners know that Hillary Clinton is running for president.
People haven't been noticing that. I think it's good to remind people of that.
Yeah, good. Well, I mean, you know, I like to think of our listeners as busy people with real lives. You know, they tune into us every week to hear about the things that happen, and we tell them at a minimum three things that occurred, and then they walk into their lives well armed with the knowledge that a thing happened. So this has been maybe the most carefully choreographed and scripted campaign rollout, as if I can remember. They're all carefully scripted and choreographed, but there's something exacting about this. What do you think Hillary Clinton is being so mindful of just at the start of this?
I think she's being mindful of the fact that she lost in 2008.
Right, I remember that happening too.
But honestly, I think she's done a pretty good job so far. She has really learned a lot of the lessons of 2008, where she came out with her helicopter, very different than a gyroscope, and acted like she was going to win this and everyone should treat her like she was the next president. And she is not doing that this time. And she is treating this more like her Senate run in New York State, where she definitely was not a shoo-in to win. New Yorkers were very skeptical of her. I lived in New York State at the time, thought she was a carpetbagger, and just thought that she was going to come in and use the state just to sort of promote herself. And she won New Yorkers over. She was humble. She went around the state to all sorts of little towns in upstate New York, did her listening tour, and she ended up winning and being a good senator for the state. And so I think that she is taking lessons from that, which is pretty smart.
And she's out of the gate talking about economic issues or kitchen table issues without specifically citing any policies. You know, her rollout video, where she announced her candidacy, was all a whole bunch of people talking about economic insecurity, essentially. And that is the issue that I think animates the Democratic Party the most right now, is economic policy issues. And you know, I don't think she's going to face a serious challenger for the primary, but she does need to get people out to vote. And that's one way to get people animated.
What's interesting about this whole process with me is that, A, she doesn't have a competitor, and so the media attaches this trope to her candidacy. Well, a competitor would make her better, which is, you know, one of those fact-free assertions.
Is that your Mitch McConnell impression?
I don't know what that was.
That was pretty close.
I don't know what that was. Sorry.
Just say Cole.
We're recording this, like, literally an hour earlier than we normally do, and I am way off my game. I'm still, like, half asleep. I'd still rather be at home with my cat and my wife in bed, you know. And I'm pathetic. It's like, it's actually like 10:30. I'm the worst. Yeah.
It's 4 in the afternoon, Jason. Now.
Sorry, yeah.
It's Tuesday.
This podcast already happened. But there's what I find funny is that as carefully patterned and scripted as this launch is, the media is so hungry for the complete package. Like, I think that it's interesting that she's chosen to go small at first and then sort of release over time her policy positions. Because the artifice of this, of course, is that she's meeting with ordinary people and those ordinary people are going to shape her policy positions. But reporters are like, no, we need to know now what your plan is. I gotta have it right now. Why are you in that Chipotle? Why are you not ordering sofritas? And then they chase, and there's that hilarious moment.
Should have ordered sofritas. That's my favorite. That's my favorite at Chipotle.
I've not had the sofritas, but I've been meaning to
try
them.
It's awesome. Oh, but the Alex Seitzwald friend of the show video from MSNBC.
Yeah, where all those pathetic boobs were running after her van, all in the hopes of maybe getting a tiny, you know, blurry photograph of her, like, walking into a door.
Or out of a van.
Or out of the van. You know, it would have definitely been, you know, Pulitzer-worthy material. Can we not have any calm in this world?
It's also, like, still 18 months away, the election is.
I know.
We have a long way to go.
Although I will say, if I was there, I would have been running to the van.
No, you wouldn't.
Yes, I would have been. No. Maybe I wouldn't have started the running.
No.
But if everyone else was going there, I would have run too.
I'll tell you what.
You don't want to be there. You don't want to. You will look ridiculous. And there are a lot of times as a reporter you look ridiculous. Luckily, most of them are not live on air. But you don't want to be the one missing out if she happens to come out and does say something to the press. And you know it's very, very remote that she will. But you have to be there. So I
That's
don't
the thing about
like
me,
it,
man.
But I would have been there.
I'm only too willing to miss out.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, fuck that.
I'd have been like, everybody's going to get this story. I'll get something else.
Right.
Let's see what's behind this rock.
Right.
But you know, was she going to say anything? No, she really wasn't. And, you know, I think that, you know, people are a little too obsessed with her right now. But if you're there, I think you're going to go with everyone else and try to see what she says.
Maybe the point is to not be there right now.
I think that might be part of the point, yes.
Interesting that we weren't there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, you know, I suppose they could have, like, she could have, like, jumped out of the van and tripped and, like, revealed that she did Benghazi. And it would have been, like, really awkward if no one had been there to capture
Can
that.
We also just praise Alex Seitzwald for a moment? Because he's great. And the way he handled that live on air was just so dignified but vaguely smirking as well. I just thought it was perfect.
I think he was dying of laughter.
He was trying to hold it back but couldn't
Although, if he was not on air, I bet he would have been running to the van, too.
Yes. And probably laughing about it. It while he was
no, I believe in Alex Seitz.
Yep.
Alex would have sent his cat, who was once the Salon Washington D.C. bureau chief. Actually, little known fact: Alex Seitzwald's cat was Salon's Washington correspondent. So you just mentioned the whole idea that she's sort of like leading with economic insecurity, mm-hmm. kitchen table issues, and this is like obviously really, really important for her to establish because of the imaginary threat of an Elizabeth Warren candidacy, which exists in the minds of the media because Hillary Clinton needs a foil to, you know, make her better. But it also exists more substantively in the minds of people who have watched this Democratic Party kind of slowly and perhaps hesitantly try to transform itself from the party that deregulated everything during Hillary Clinton's husband's administration to one that's sort of started to wake up to the idea that all that was a huge mistake, and that economic inequality has become deeply entrenched. One of the things I find very interesting about it is that for all of the rhetoric she's put forth so far, when you ask Wall Streeters, hey, are you mad at Hillary Clinton for saying this stuff? Are you worried that she's like going to come after you with pitchforks? They're like, nah. We know the you know, the Wall Street set are just like, we know Hillary Clinton's just, you know, it's just politics. She's got to say that stuff. We're not worried about her. We're not afraid of her. And there's this amazing quote that Kia Macarecci at Vanity Fair got from a guy who put his name to it. Okay, Robert Wolf, the CEO of UBS America.
Oh, he's Obama's favorite Wall Streeter. He's very close to the Obama campaign.
Yeah, okay. So he said, I do not view Hillary Clinton, what Hillary Clinton said, as populist or far left. She's not saying a hedge fund manager shouldn't be making what they're making, just that someone in another job shouldn't be making 300 times less. Which is like, wow, I mean, that's a vague fucking worldview right there. Like, according to the 2015 GlobeCap Hedge Fund Compensation Report, the average hedge fund manager made $2.4 million annually that year. 300 times less than that is $8,000. So that's really fucking generous. She's just saying people should make at least $9,000 a year. We're okay with that. That's fine. You know, it's like if she had said, you know, people should not be making 100 times less money than hedge fund managers, we'd start to get a little nervous. But we're not worried about that. That's fine. So.
But you hear this a lot from people when inequality comes up. They say, well, inequality is just the result of rich people making more money. There's nobody who gets wronged by rich people getting richer. It's everything was fine, and now it's a little bit better for other people. And I think particularly in the financial world, that's a little bit myopic because there is evidence the financial sector in the United States is too big, that we have an over-financialized economy, and that having that big a financial sector where it's easy to make a lot of money, because what do? You throw money around all day. That actually cannibalizes other parts of the economy and makes it harder for people to make a decent living in those parts of the economy. So I think that perspective is wrong. But, you know, I don't work on Wall Street and I don't have a whole bunch of guys barking in my ear about how awesome I am all the time because I made so much money. And people on Wall Street, for better or for worse, you know, they do sort of view their own sense of self-worth in financial terms because that's what they have to do all day. They've got to work with money. And so the world starts to look a little bit different to somebody in that profession than it does in anywhere else.
But the interesting thing is that they're not worried about this at all.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, what they cry a thousand tears every time Elizabeth Warren says, like, hey, we should break up the big banks, right?
Right.
And it's clearly like an emotional response that happens. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren's been in the Senate for a couple of years. Have you seen any banks get broken up? Like, it hasn't happened. Like, she's a very, very powerful spokesman for the, I think, what's now the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But, you know, what used to be sort of a common sense, let's protect markets view that was bipartisan. She's a powerful spokesman for that, but there's very little danger that she's actually going to change anything in the near future because the rest of the Senate is totally
right,
owned
exactly.
by Wall Street.
Exactly. And that may be something that Wall Street understands is that despite what Obama said when he came into office, that he was going to change the way Washington works, you don't really change the way Washington works. You know, even as president, you can do a lot, obviously, but you can't change everything. And so if you really wanted to make a big difference, like what sort of Senate, what sort of House are we going to have? Probably the House will still be controlled by Republicans. So what are you really going to get to do? And maybe Wall Street, you know, they're in on the joke and they realize what's going on. Or maybe Hillary Clinton is whispering in their ear that she's not going to do anything, which would be interesting.
Maybe that's what it is, because what's interesting to me is that they were never in on the same joke when Barack Obama talked about this. And I think Barack Obama was also like Hillary Clinton, secretly just pursuing the artifice of populism as opposed to the practical application of populism. Maybe the fact that Obamacare as a concept literally does redistribute wealth from wealthy people to poor people, and that got them mad. But What happened under the Obama administration? If you're a titan of finance, your profits went skyrocketed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You recovered out of the recession faster than anybody else.
But he called you a fat cat.
Right, that's
called you a fat cat, Jason.
That one time. Like I didn't. You know what? I didn't know that the word fat cat was really that wounding. You know, I thought like fat cat is like, you know, what old timer cartoons say, you know, the rich guy.
You imagine the Monopoly guy or something.
Right, exactly. Old timey cars crash into each other.
Bull feathers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just like crazy. Like, I was like, damn, if I know that like that word was like literally like the white privilege to Wall Street, I would have called them fat cats a long time ago. I would have like thrown them off their game. That's just amazing to me. It's like I thought fat cat was just like a cartoon word. Apparently it is like a racial slur to people who who work on Wall Street.
But remember, we had Barney Frank in the office a few months ago, and maybe a year ago now. And that was one of the things he said. He said, you know, the hardest thing for the Obama administration sort of politically in dealing with the moneyed class was that he'd hurt their feelings. It was had nothing to do with policy. He said he really didn't think that the wealthy had been really harmed in any way by the Obama administration, but he really had hurt their feelings.
I thought that's amazing. You made a certain amount of money, like you just didn't have feelings anymore.
You shouldn't care. You are rich enough. What's the point of being rich, right?
You still have feelings. That's ridiculous.
I mean, I guess they have to wake up in the morning, get dressed, look at themselves in the mirror, and justify what they're doing to themselves.
No
one wants to think that, you know, no one wants to feel like they're what they've been doing all their life is meaningless and empty. Or maybe some people are okay with that, but I don't know. I mean, I don't make tons and tons and tons of money on Wall Street, so I don't really know.
That's a radical idea. That's a radical idea that like someone who makes that much money may retain some semblance of a soul or conscience.
I think they do. And a lot of them are Democrats too. A lot have been Democrats for a long period of time, and they don't want to feel like they are a traitor to the party.
I know. To their
movement.
To be honest with you, this makes being like super duper wealthy less appealing to me, because I thought the whole point was to just like get to this exalted place where you are bulletproof.
This is why wealthy people give
like
so much
Kanye.
Money to philanthropy.
Yeah. there are studies on this though. There's studies like happiness studies.
It's great to keep an opera house open when people are on stamps.
But it turns out that like money does make you happier up to a certain point,
right?
But after about $40,000 or $50,000 a year, it stops making you mm-hmm. happier. And the more you make, it's not that it makes you less happy, but it just stops. The increased wealth does not result in any more happiness for you. And it's sort of like the line at which you can start to afford some luxury goods. Like you start swapping out like your crappy couch for a nice couch.
So do you think that the dictators who literally steal the wealth of their people, like the Bashar Assads, they aren't actually happy?
No, I don't think that. No happier than the guy who's swapping out his ratty old couch for a nice new leather one.
I mean, maybe I should just sit down with Bashar al-Assad with a cup of tea and be like, is this making you happy? Like, are you enjoying this?
I mean, there's a reason why, like, presidents' hair gets, like, gray and stuff as they're in office. It's not like they actually, you know, it's stressful and not fun to be to be making those decisions.
Oh, right. That's true.
Well, I mean, which is not to say that I have a whole lot of sympathy for Bashar al-Assad, but to be clear.
Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. Well, let's keep on this weird topic of money and like holding on to money for a long time, because Zach, you wrote what I guess was a super controversial story about the estate tax.
Yes, Republicans call this the death tax, and they have been crusading against it for several decades.
I'm actually a little surprised that Republicans just picked that one tax to call death.
I know. You would think that, you know, but
like there's nowhere else to go from there. Everything else is like, oh, I'm just hurt a little bit.
It's certainly better named than an estate tax. I mean, who feels bad for someone who has an estate?
Right. My estate has been. Yeah. Who will take the South Lawn? But also it's not very creative. Death and taxes is already sort of a catchphrase. So combining them, you know,
I just got that marketing.
So anyway, aside from the bad marketing, it's not a death tax, because you don't get taxed on things when you die, because you're dead. You can't do anything anymore. You don't have an estate anymore. You're dead. The estate tax is, I think, better understood as the Paris Hilton inheritance tax. It is a tax on the heirs who receive the fortunes of dead people after the dead people die. And I was surprised. I got more hate mail for this story than for, I think, anything I've written in the last, like, 6 months. It was wild. It only applies to people who are millionaires. If you leave behind as an individual less than $5.43 million this year, nothing you leave behind will be taxed. $0 will be taxed. The government will take nothing. If you are married, you get to bump that off until your spouse gets bumped off, and then it's $10.86 million. So we're only talking about huge, huge fortunes getting taxed. It, in fact, applies to only about 4,700 households a year, which is about 0.2% of the people who die each year. 0.2, not 2%, one-fifth of 1%.
I do wish more people would die every year.
Well, it would probably lower that number and make this seem even more obscene, in addition to all the dead people everywhere. So it's a tax on the wealthiest people in the country, and it's a tax on unearned income. I got a whole lot of nasty grams about using the word handout. We used the word handout in the headline. I'm like, well, what do you call it when the government changes the policy so that you get a big chunk of money that you didn't earn?
I call it a windfall.
Right. We could have used windfall. Yeah, that would be fair. But it's actually a fairly expensive tax. It's fairly substantive, even though only 4,700 people, our households are subjected to it. It brings in about $269 billion over 10 years. And Republicans, who had been going around screaming their heads off about out-of-control deficits for several years, are not proposing to do anything with the lost revenue. They're just going to say, well, we'll take a $269 billion hit to the deficit, and that's fine. I tend to think that deficit hyperventilation is silly, but of all the ways to raise money if you are worried about the deficit, the estate tax is the most obvious one. It's unearned income going to wealthy people. There really aren't any good arguments that I've heard in favor of it, in part because it's narrowed so much over the last 20 years. And while this has been a Republican crusade, since the 1990s, Democrats have repeatedly inked these bipartisan deals where the Democrats will get something like child health care for poor kids, and the Republicans will get a narrowing of the estate tax, so more and more income will be exempted from it. So in 97, when Clinton signed the first of these, about 2% of dead people were subjected to the tax. Still a very small number, but that's shrunk by a factor of 10 since then.
I have a question. Legendarily, if you think back to old school American robber barons, there were many among them who took the view, fuck you, kids, you're not getting any of my money. I'm not leaving you shit. I'm going to give all my money away, and then you're going to have to go earn your own.
Mm-hmm.
What changed in America that allowed very rich people to start viewing their children as something other than a bunch of useless dicks?
Well, there's that that Bob Dylan song, the lyric, I'm helpless like a rich man's child. I mean,
could
that,
you sing
that
it like Bob Dylan for me?
I don't know. Are there copyright issues with that? I don't know. Rich man's wild.
So you can understand how maybe this didn't cross over. But okay.
Look, that is a stereotype that's out there. Everybody who knows wealthy families knows
you
at least somebody
who's. You were the one who invoked Paris Hilton, not me.
Right.
A rich dick.
I've never met Paris Hilton. I have nothing bad to say about her.
No, she's a rich dick.
Okay, well, it is interesting that used to be sort of a mark of pride among the American elite. And I actually don't think all 4,700 of the families that are subjected to this tax each year, vigorously oppose it. I think a lot of them think it's perfectly fair.
Yeah.
But there are a handful who are very politically influential who are able to move this. I mean, it's no coincidence, for instance, that one of the few Democratic backers of getting rid of the estate tax used to be Senator Blanche Lincoln. Blanche Lincoln is from Arkansas, and one of the wealthiest families in the country is the Walton family, who control Walmart. It just takes one Walton family in Arkansas to move that senator.
Family filled to the brim with rich dicks.
They seem to be having a lot of problems with business practices that that their workers don't seem to be happy with. It's just it's remarkable that, I mean, I don't think this is even something that most wealthy people care about. But all you need is a dozen, and you can buy the whole Republican Party and get Democrats to sign off on it. And it's really sad that's the thing that Republicans are always asking for in these bipartisan budget deals.
And I think Republicans actually have done a good job in marketing it and making it an issue. I know death tax is sort of a silly term, but you know, when people hear about it, it's like, so when I die, everything I pass on is going to be taxed. And you have to explain, as you did, which takes a little bit of time. No, it doesn't apply to you.
You don't have shit, so no one's going to tax it.
You know, death tax is people immediately get an image in their mind of what it is. And it just seems un-American. It seems like this isn't what should happen. But
kicking somebody while they're down or dead.
Right, exactly. Like, why this person is grieving. Why should we tax them? But the person, you know, the little guy down the street who it wants to pass on his house to his daughter, that's not the person this applies to. But Republicans have just hammered this so much and marketed it in such a way that I think that, you know, I think Democrats need to catch up a little.
Do you think that if more Americans knew that by supporting the estate tax, they're simply subsidizing rich dickdom forever, they might change their mind about that?
I think so. And it's what's interesting about this particular repeal, and Republicans voted on it this week and it passed easily because it was the House and they control the House. Democrats did not vote for it. It was, you know, kind of interesting. But this particular repeal also doesn't change anything with the capital gains tax. So when you die, your income that's been in the stock market for years and years doesn't even get subjected to the 20% capital gains tax. So it's not only are you missing out on the estate tax, you're also missing out on the capital gains tax, which means literally wealthy families can just pop their money down in the stock market, watch it get bigger and bigger and bigger, never take it out, pass it on to their kids, and have it never get taxed from generation to generation to generation. And we all know that the way to get rich is not to work hard. It is to have capital assets that make a lot of money in the
right.
stock market.
Right.
So it's actually a very, very dangerous change that does the exact opposite of what, you know, Thomas Piketty and people who are worried about inherited wealth becoming sort of this permanent fixture of inequality have been advocating to do.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny, you know, talk about Thomas Piketty. One of the things that he's talked about in terms of R greater than G is that in popular literature, mankind has always sort of like confronted this notion. And so it's like it's in a lot of ways riven in our popular consciousness. But for some reason.
Right. Charles Dickens books.
Our producer, who was in our ear just a minute ago, pointed out that this death tax is originated with some of that Frank Luntz. Mm-hmm. Prestidigitation. It's interesting because it's that level of marketing has simply been able to transform minds from what they know deep down about society to toss that in the garbage and now view this.
Don't tax my sick grandma.
Right.
Yeah.
You get an immediate image in your head of what you think this is, even though it's completely wrong.
Right. Well, all I would say is that most of you out there in the wide world, you don't make enough money to be qualified for the death tax. If you get there and you want the death tax to be repealed, I hardly blame you. But remember,
I do. This is part of living in a decent society.
All right, I blame you. I blame you a little bit. But my experience is that you know, like I said, I came to the table today just sort of automatically assuming after you make a lot of money, you don't have feelings or conscience or a soul anymore. And so, like, I could hardly expect someone who bought their way into an exalted state of sociopathy to then, you know, really turn on a dime and start revealing fellow feeling for other people. So I've learned a lot today. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Hooray for souls.
Today we had Amanda Turkle, HuffPost Politics Managing Editor, who's actually a little bit more important to us in our life than she herself gave her credit for on this podcast. You can follow her on Twitter at A-T-E-R-K-E-L, A Turkle. You should also follow at Turkle Rage, T-E-R-K-E-L-R-A-G-E.
Which is not run by me.
Which is not run by Amanda Turkle. Amanda knows nothing about it. She neither approves of nor regrets it. We're
That's
also
true.
Here, Zach Carter. Zach Carter is a senior political economy reporter of the Huffington Post. You can follow him at Zach D. Carter. As we've explained before, it's Zach as in Zach, Z-A-C-H.
Correct.
Followed by D. Carter. His actual name is DeCarter. DeCarter. There's like an apostrophe there.
It's Zach, French.
Zach DeCarter. He is a French gentleman who wears berets and smokes cloves. and is a full communist. and and I am Chase Lincolns. I edit Eat the Press at thehuffingtonpost.com. You can follow me at Deceiver, which is D-C-E-I-V-E-R. Basically, the word deceiver if you get rid of the first E. Because I did the
I before E, except after deceiver.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Thanks, guys. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki, with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta and Adriana Usero. I'm Jason Lincolns. This week, we were joined by HuffPost reporters Zach Carter and Amanda Turkle. So That Happened is available on iTunes, so check us out on the iTunes store and look for the Huffington Post whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, just send us an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, we thank you for listening, and we miss you already.